Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. Getting to college isn't always easy to do, but even less so for kids who come from disadvantaged backgrounds. We'll talk about one program to help make college happen for them in just a couple of moments. But first, as we continue to reflect on events in Ferguson since the Michael Brown shooting, one area has undergone increasing scrutiny, the role of the faith community. Our first guest today has taken a close look through a series of interviews and observations and through her own personal activism, all of which resulted in a book that helps tell the story. It's titled Ferguson and Faith, Sparking Leadership and Awakening a Community. The author is Professor Leah Gunning Francis, Assistant Professor of Christian Education and Associate Dean of Contextual Education at Eden Theological Seminary. Dr. Francis joins me in studio. So nice to have you with us. Thanks.
Thank you, Don.
You say in your book that Ferguson was a wake-up call. Let's start there. What exactly do you mean by that?
Ferguson awakened us to issues of racial injustice that have often laid sort of below the surface and out of sight of many people. There's a quote in the book by Arundhati Roy that says, "Once you see, you can't unsee." So not only seeing the images of Michael Brown's body on the ground, but also seeing the ways in which thousands of people have responded to say that racial profiling, police brutality, this is a very serious issue in this country, and we can no longer pretend that it doesn't exist.
What made this situation, this case, different? It certainly wasn't the first case. There had been numerous cases just within the last year or two prior to the Michael Brown shooting. What made this different?
I think what made this one different was first the image of his body. Because of social media and people having cell phones at the scene, being able to broadcast his image around the world in rapid fire time just really struck a chord with a lot of people. You know, it was in an apartment community, a relatively small community where there were children outside, a lot of people coming and going on what was just a typical Saturday afternoon. So you had so many people, if not witness the exact event, witness the aftermath of it, and the way in which people were able to tweet images of his body just captured and captivated attention.
Well, immediately after it happened, there was a call from several sectors of the community to begin a, quote, conversation about what had happened. Where are we, do you think, in that conversation right now?
I think the conversation has started, but there are many more conversations that need to be had. My approach was to engage clergy and to get a sense of what they were doing and what they were saying and how they were perceiving our community at large, our society, can live toward a future filled with hope. And so Ferguson and Faith is an opportunity to hear not only some of their conversations, but also to bear witness, if you will, to their actions and activities, the ways in which they use their bodies, their resources, their social capital to support young people, to de-escalate situations that were tense, and equally as important, to call our country to account, to say racial profiling, police brutality is unacceptable and needs to be changed.
You know, one of the things that I noticed throughout all of this was how the role of the faith community seemed to change from my perspective, watching from this vantage point, if you will. That being that early on, the pulpit was busy and there was a lot being said, but I wasn't sure that anybody in the streets was listening. What do you think?
Well, the ways in which people in the streets started to listen was when clergy vacated the pulpit and went into the streets. So to be able to stand next to a clergy person, a man or a woman, and to have them talking to young people, to listen to them, to hear their frustrations, their concern, that changed a lot of the dynamics and the relationship. You know, in Ferguson and Faith, some of the young people I talked to, they talk about how they're not accustomed to clergy engaging them at their level in terms of treating them with respect and treating them as a peer and treating them as a valued person whose voice matters.
You know, that activism has been most evident just in the last couple of days. We've looked at the papers and we've seen people we all know, like Starsky Wilson of the Ferguson Commission, whom you have in your book, Susan Talvey, Rabbi Susan Talvey, who is also a part of your book and part of your conversations. The last picture I saw of either one of them was they were being put in handcuffs. So that's what you're talking about.
Absolutely. You know, they went to the Department of Justice on Monday, which was titled Another Moral Monday Action, to call and ask the U.S. Attorney Richard Callahan to go to Washington, D.C. and demand that the Department of Justice put an end to racially biased policing. We believe there needs to be more transparency with police departments in terms of their stats. The Department of Justice's own report right here in Ferguson revealed the extensive amount of racially biased policing that exists in Ferguson. And we believe it exists all around the country. So to have more transparency, as well as integrating more sensitivity training and community-based alternatives to incarceration.
You know, this is not new also. You mentioned the Justice Department report. The Ferguson Commission is going to say essentially the same thing. People that we've talked to on this program say the same thing. The question is, how quickly is this likely to happen?
Well, you know, steps need to be happening continuously. You know, we know that all of this is not going to change overnight. And we also know that there may not be as many people as needed to want it to change overnight. But what the clergy are so instrumental in doing right now is pushing the conversations both within faith communities as well as to the Justice Department and others. So it's happening on multiple fronts to try to help move this movement forward. And again, as we know, it's not only clergy. You know, they are parts of other organizations that are working toward this end as well.
What's the most surprising or perhaps even stunning thing you heard in your conversations?
Wow. There was one. Many may recall when the St. Louis University campus was occupied.
Sure.
Shortly after Von Derrick Myers was killed. And there is a church in South St. Louis, Compton Heights Christian Church, that was very instrumental in opening its doors and allowing its use of space, its sanctuary for prayer, feeding people, you know, just really being a welcoming place of hospitality. The pastor of that church told me that toward the end of that time, a young woman came to her and wanted to give her money. And the pastor said, "No, we don't want any money. We're not doing this for money." And the young woman said, "Why are your doors open to us?" And that just broke my heart wide open, because what she was saying was there are so many places, so many faith communities that ostracize and alienate young people because of how they look or how they dress or whom they choose to love. And to be able to be a part of a community that truly welcomed who she was and what she was about was transforming for her and for that church and many others. And so that was, we know those things have happened, but to actually hear that was just very stunning for me and transforming.
How is the activism of the clergy in various denominations playing amongst their congregations?
It varies. Mm-hmm. You know, there were some that were on board with it and others who would say, "Do you have to preach another sermon about Ferguson? Why are we still talking about this? We don't want a Black Lives Matter sign in front of our church." You know, so there were a range of responses within congregations.
You know, that you bring up an interesting point, because I think a lot of people, certainly in the white community and perhaps in the black, are tired of it. Have you found that at all?
Well,
I'm tired of the Ferguson story.
Sure. What I've found is that most of the time, the people who are tired of it are people who can choose to be tired of it. So I'm a mother of two African-American sons, and so I don't have the luxury of ever being tired of pursuing justice for a more equitable treatment of young black men and women in our society. So the tiredness often comes with privilege. And a lot of the clergy talk about the role of white privilege and how we need white people to do their own work in naming privilege and understanding the ways in which white privilege, which is solely being given advantages for the color of one's skin, how that too often works to undermine people of color and especially African Americans.
What do you hear, if anything, that's different between those African-American members of the clergy that you spoke with and the whites?
One of the things I heard that was different, especially around the matter of white privilege, while both of them would talk about it, many of the white clergy I talked to named it as an integral part of their calling. In other words, they feel called to work with their family members, their congregations, people in their circles to address this issue.
I was among the millions who watched the GOP debate last week. Mm-hmm. Did you see it?
I didn't. I was involved in Ferguson activities.
What I found stunning about that was the fact that there was virtually no discussion about the kinds of things that we're talking about. Oh. It came up very briefly toward the end, but there was no discussion of social injustice or racial issues, which makes me wonder, you know, if we talk about the rest of the nation listening and the conversations that are starting, and here at the highest level with people who aspire to the presidency, they're not talking about it.
And there's a reason they're not talking about it, because for them to talk about it would also require that they do something about it. And this is why the Black Lives Matter movement has gained the kind of traction that it has, because it's forcing those who are in positions of power to, you know, realize we're not going away. We're not going to stop talking about it. And we are going to continue to organize for the good of Black lives.
What is wrong with people like Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders saying all lives matter? They are criticized for saying that as opposed to specifying Black Lives Matter.
Mm-hmm. The reason they're criticized for it is because so often all lives matter is interpreted as a slight against Black Lives Matter. In other words, to say that, you know, if I say Black Lives Matter and you say, well, all lives matter, you know, I instantly interpret that as you're dismissing what I'm saying. And we have seen too often that Black lives have, in fact, not mattered. We know the economic, the educational, the incarceration disparities between Black people and white people. So until Black lives truly matter, it is then and only then that we'll be able to say that all lives matter.
You know, I think it's only recently that a lot of people, probably most people, are getting a picture of that. You're probably familiar with the For Sake of All a survey that was done here, which proved definitively how these disparities work and the difference in life expectancy, 18 years between zip codes that are adjacent to each other, simply based on poverty and health issues. I think people are beginning to understand that a little bit better now.
I think they are, but there's still a long way to go with it. And so, you know, with Jason Purnell's work with the For Sake of All and so many other work with, you know, to really help people understand the scope and the magnitude of the disparities is critical.
Yeah. I have to take a break. We'll do that now and come back. Continue our conversation with Professor Leah Gunning Francis, Assistant Professor of Christian Education and Associate Dean of Contextual Education at Eden Theological Seminary, and the author of a book, Ferguson and Faith, Sparking Leadership and Awakening Community, which is about precisely what we've been talking about here on the program. We'll come back, continue the conversation. If you'd like to be a part of it, we'd love to hear from you. Give us a call at 382-8255. That's 382-TALK. You can send us an email to talk@stlpublicradio.org or send us a tweet at STL on air. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Now back to our conversation with Professor Leah Gunning Francis. One thing we must talk about, and you put a lot of emphasis on it in your book, the role of young people. I mean, that's where the energy is coming from. And what I'm interested in is the connect between the clergy and the young people, There is a generational component to all of this, isn't there?
There is. For many of the young people that I, for the young people that I interviewed, they were intricately connected to clergy as a result of Ferguson. So in other words, for many of them, they got to know clergy on the streets of Ferguson. They began to see the church and what the church can be and should be because of the clergy that came and stood with them in Ferguson. One of the chapters talks about Jesus is in the streets. In other words, they're saying that the church came to us instead of requiring that we go to the church.
Millennials, however, at this stage are not known as churchgoers.
Yes, but they are known as people of faith and spirituality. So they're not people that are disconnected from a sense of purpose and vocation and spirituality, but seeking to find it in other ways. And they're seeking to find it in ways that are real and honest and connected and relevant to their lives.
We have a couple of people who would like to get into this conversation. As time allows, let's bring them in. We'll start with Tom, who is calling from Afton. Tom, go ahead, please. You're on the air.
Thanks, Don. You know, I think the main issue with Ferguson, of all the issues that have been brought to light, you know, racism and the racial divide in St. Louis, poverty in the black community, but I really think if you ask the mothers of the people who've been, the unarmed people who've been shot, they would say that the main issue that we're concerned about right now is a high level of police violence against U.S. citizens, especially the brunt is borne by the black community. And I really think that when we start talking about that white privilege rhetoric, that people who share these concerns about the violation of constitutional rights start turning against each other instead of working together. And it's an old tactic that has been used by the power structures in America for centuries now to turn working class people against each other by getting them to focus on what their differences are instead of their commonalities. And so I would encourage your guests to consider that and really refocus on what we can do to get the police to stop killing unarmed black people. Thank you.
Would you like to respond?
One of the ways to have them attend to this issue of killing unarmed black people is to recognize racial bias. We have to name it. We have to help people see that, you know, there are biases that exist in many people. And so long as we're not naming it, it's going to be all the more difficult to get to the root of it and seek to stop it.
Well, let's take another call. We'll take one from Ferguson. We'll be joined by Ron calling from that community. Go ahead, Ron.
Yes, the Black Lives Matter is a good campaign, but it needs to have some real teeth in it. You know, we have in St. Louis 600 shootings a year, almost all young African-American males shooting each other. And if you look at the overall predictor of crime, it's not graduating from high school and not having a father in the home. And I think what that's the church has failed us. These young people need stable families, and they don't talk about that in the church. You know, absentee fathers is the number one cause of crime. If we didn't have a high crime rate, we wouldn't have that many police officers out on the streets, and they wouldn't have as much reasons to stop folks. So I think the ministers allowed this to happen. This didn't just start yesterday. They have been silent on employment discrimination, everything, and now all of a sudden they become the new Jesus for us. They need to do their jobs.
Thanks, Ron.
What we need is government at its highest levels first doing their jobs. We need state legislators putting policies in place that don't foster these wide economic and educational gaps. That's where the lapse has been and needs to be corrected.
Doesn't he have a point, however? This situation with Michael Brown and the whole overall situation in Ferguson didn't happen in a vacuum. This has been going on for years and years and years. Has the clergy fulfilled its responsibilities over the last decades to step forward and have the outcry that was necessary to change things?
Well, I think if we look in St. Louis specifically, the ways in which clergy have tried over the years to call attention to issues of violence in St. Louis. So, for example, the call to oneness that happened 7 years ago with thousands of people in the streets calling to an end for violence. Has there been enough of an effort with everybody really doing taking a hard look of what's causing the violence? Absolutely not. Nobody gets a gold star here. But what it is a call for every sector of our community to take seriously and investigate why the violence is happening and take responsibility for it.
You are a relative newcomer to this community, having come from New Jersey, 7 years ago?
7 years. Mm-hmm.
My home state, by the way, so that makes you a very special person. But were you surprised by what you found here? I mean, St. Louis has a reputation for the racial polarization that has existed here for many, many years.
Here's what surprised me about St. Louis. First, I had no idea it's as family-friendly a city as it is. You know, we have had tremendous opportunities for our children here and family, that it's been absolutely wonderful. But I was also at the same time surprised to see the racial polarization, to live in a neighborhood where we were the only Black family anywhere in that neighborhood for so long until we moved recently into the city. So, you know, to hear those things, but to actually live it and experience it has been surprising.
Right. Here's a question from Bob in St. Louis County. He has tweeted or emailed. He asks, how can you sugarcoat the behavior of looting and blocking highways? There is another side. And I'll add to that, as a lot of white folks out there are basically turned off by these tactics.
Mm-hmm.
And they could be allies.
Mm-hmm. The tactics of looting and whatnot, that's a separate matter from the protests because, you know, looting is a crime. Those things are criminal acts. That's not protesting for justice. So it's unfair to suggest that just because some people might take advantage of this and doing it in the name of Mike Brown, that is representative of what this movement's about. It's not. Those are really two separate matters.
Well, you know, media comes into play here, doesn't it? Because that's what you're seeing on television. And it's always, a fire is going to get precedence over almost anything else or this kind of behavior.
Absolutely. And that's one of the reasons I was asked to write Ferguson and Faith, because we knew the world had seen all of those images and needed to hear on the ground real-time perspectives of people that actively engaged in this work.
Take another call. Chris will join us from St. Louis. Chris, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Yeah, thank you so much for having this conversation. A couple of things jumped out at me. One note from yesterday's conversation about this, one of the callers had said something about like-minded people. And then today, Don, you said something about a lot of whites are tired of the conversation. And then you mentioned the frustration with all lives matter. And I'm a white male, privileged without any question about it. And this conversation is so long overdue. I can't even begin to tell you. And this is just so important. And when I hear friends and colleagues say, well, you know, shouldn't all lives matter? It makes my head explode because they're not listening. And that's not at all what the Black Lives Matter folks are saying. They do say that everybody's lives matter. But what they're asking us all to listen to is to just pay attention to this part of our population that we have ignored for decades and generations. And we owe it to them. We owe it to them to make them a priority and to take care of those communities, these children, these kids, these young men, and make this right. And we can't wait any longer. And I'm impatient with people who don't get that. And I'm sorry if I seem a little strident about it, but we can't sit back any longer. We've got to make this work. So
strident is not a word.
My call.
Strident is not a word that comes to mind with what you've just said, Chris. I think it's passion that is showing. You're not going to take any exception to anything that he said.
I think you're right on. You know, so many of the people I talk to in the book talk about the need for our white brothers and sisters to name this, work toward changing it. Hey, look, the holidays are coming. These holiday conversations are going to be happening. It's time to say to Uncle Joe or Aunt Sue, you know, it's no longer appropriate to talk about black people in these ways, and we just can't continue to do this.
Our time is winding down. Let's get another call in. We'll bring in Dale calling from Belleville. Dale, go ahead. You're on the air.
Professor, thank you for speaking to Don and for this conversation. I long to hear basic facts stated. I find that the biggest problem to conversation about what has taken place with the Mike Brown death has been that two extensive forensic investigations took place, including by the Attorney General's office, the Department of Justice, and I don't think you would call that a racist investigation. And they found that all of what was being said, by clergy included, of those who were wanting to bring racial justice to Ferguson, was that he actually had his hand in the car. He was threatening Officer Wilson. He had gunpowder on his hand. He was not turning around, running away, hands up. I don't understand how you can go on and on without accepting the basic fact that this has harmed and vilified and humiliated this young 24-year-old man who has a young wife who was pregnant at the time. Why can't you simply state the truth?
Thank you for the call, Dale. Thank you for the call. That is somewhat off point in as much as, you know, whatever the circumstances were of the Michael Brown shooting, and there have been much discussion about that, it's what followed and what was determined that life was like, the social justice issues that emerged as a result of that incident are a most important factor in all of this.
And part of that, which is another important fact, is that at that time, Michael Brown was not seen as a human being. In Officer Wilson's own words, he said he felt like a 5-year-old boy holding on to Hulk Hogan with demon eyes. That's not seeing a human being. And what the clergy are calling for is that all young black men are first seen as human beings created in the image of God, not as thugs, not as gangsters, not as villains. And too often our society has demonized them in that way so that anybody who happens to come upon one assumes that's what they are.
Right. I'm going to take one more call, but it has to be quick, from Judith in University City. Judith, please make your question or comment quick.
Yes, this is from, I am an ELCA Lutheran pastor, semi-retired, and I just wanted to talk about the level of response within our own denomination. It varied, and I believe that it has to do with the where the congregation is within the St. Louis area. Pastors have hesitated to speak out because of separation of church and state issues, and I think they have a sense of where their congregations are coming from already, and that this has been inhibiting. There have been some who were quite active and others not so much so. Now, I'm not saying that this is right or wrong or that the pastors took the right tack on this, but I'm saying I think a lot of it is determined geographically, and therefore they kept in mind who their congregations were and how much of an impact they actually thought they could make.
Thank you, Judith, for the call. Agree with that?
That's true. There were a lot of competing interests that went into the decisions that clergy made. So geographics, you know, their audience, a lot of that was taken into account. And what we found in my book is that a lot of clergy took risks. They took risks to state the hard truths that, you know, might not be amenable to some folks.
The book is Ferguson and Faith, Sparking Leadership and Awakening Community, by our guest Leah Gunning Francis. We have a note here from one of our callers, says, we can't get to this call, but says that the discussion of Black Lives Matter, because there's no question that white lives matter. So that's I'm not sure that I put that exactly the way it should be put. But if people are concerned about the Black Lives Matters comment and discussion, There's no question that white lives matter, so that's why that is important. We'll leave it at that. Have to. Thank you so much for being with us, Professor. Ferguson and Faith is the name of the book. Coming up, giving disadvantaged kids a helping hand getting into and succeeding in college. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU.